I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Who would have thought a few years ago that Eliot Spitzer and Anthony Weiner would be making political comebacks after both resigning from office in disgrace? Spitzer was caught in a sex scandal involving prostitutes. Weiner sent suggestive photos of himself through his Twitter account. They're both running for office in New York City. Then there's Mark Sanford, who resigned as governor of South Carolina a few years ago when he admitted that he wasn't hiking the Appalachian Trail, but had used public money to be with his girlfriend in Argentina. He was just elected to the U.S. Congress in a special election. So why do politicians want and get second chances? What will the public forgive and what is unforgivable when it comes to scandal? And joining us is John Halpin. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, directs and is the creator of the Progressive Studies Program at the Center, joining us from their studios. And John Halpin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us and joining us by telephone is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, the author of a number of books, including most recently Governing America, The Revival of Political History. And Julian, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Let me begin with you, Julian, if I could. As a historian, is there anything new about political comebacks or political second chances after a sex scandal?
They're more common than we think. Often when a sex scandal breaks, we assume that's the end of a politician. But there are many examples we can go over where politicians have just stayed in office as a sex scandal broke and survived. They're reelected or elected. And there are other cases where someone steps down or gets out of the public eye for a little while and then comes back. America likes to think it's puritanical on these matters, but there's many cases where they're willing to forgive politicians for their personal behavior.
And John Halpin, it's interesting that when we look at these second chances, they seem to be one of the few things that are bipartisan these days.
Yeah, I mean, people tend to overlook problems among their own fellow partisans, particularly when they're facing a contentious or harsh opposition race, which was the case with Sanford. They weren't about to give up that seat to the Democrats. And in the case of New York City Democrats, obviously, it's a pretty liberal environment. They're probably willing to overlook a lot of past transgressions in order to back somebody that they otherwise would believe in.
Well, I began by saying, you know, in a sense, who would think a couple of years ago that someone like Eliot Spitzer, Anthony Weiner, would be running for office again? And taking Anthony Weiner as an example to you, John Halpin, which is, you know, it's kind of embarrassing what he did a couple of years ago, but perhaps it's the passage of time.
Yeah, the political science research tends to show that time really heals, that people are forgiving, they're forgetful, and they tend to overlook things that don't particularly matter to their value system. And, you know, the Weiner situation is quite unsavory, obviously, but it wasn't illegal, technically, and it appears that he's worked things out within his own family, so people are willing to give him a second chance. And, in fact, he's doing, you know, he's in a tight mayoral primary. He's in first place right now.
And, Julian, does that matter if a family, or in this case a wife, forgives somebody? Why wouldn't the public forgive them?
I think it matters. I mean, people watch how the family reacts. You know, does the wife stand by the male politician who's been implicated in a scandal? And there are arguments that this will help a person, that if the family doesn't desert them, if the family stands by them, it gives the politician more strength to withstand the kind of media blitz that you have to get through when a sex scandal breaks. I don't think it's the only factor. I think you can get through this even without that. But certainly, in terms of the tools you need to rebuild yourself, that can be extraordinarily important. We saw that in certain respects with Hillary Clinton and President Clinton, where, you know, although there was obvious tension between them, she did stand by him and she did focus on the partisan attacks when he was president rather than on the issue at hand.
Well, speaking of standing by your man, John, this goes back to Eliot Spitzer, and I think we all remember the very uncomfortable image of his wife standing next to him as he talked about what he had done.
Yeah, I mean, it was very uncomfortable to watch in many ways. It was, you know, potentially very humiliating, a difficult situation, and you know, here's a guy who had a lot of self-confidence and hubris, and he's weeping in front of his family. It didn't look good, but, you know, according to polls just out today, the public in New York, particularly New York City Democrats, appears not to worry too much. They don't worry too much about it. In fact, 67% of New York City Democrats say they're willing to give Spitzer a second chance, according to the new mayor's poll.
So are we the French, John Halpin? Have we become the French?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think people look to politicians for guidance on morality. I mean, I think they already assume that it takes a certain type of person who may be morally suspect to be a politician in the first place. So they don't look to them for moral guidance. And, you know, they have their own standards that they apply in their own families, their own lives. When they're making an evaluation of a political candidate, I think the primary concern is, does this person share my values overall? Do they have good policies that I'll support? Are they competent? Are they capable of carrying out the duties of the office that we're trying to elect them to?
Do you agree with that, Julian, that we don't look to politicians to guide us through the moral thickets?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's various factors. So part of it, it's true that historically that's not what we're looking for our politicians. And while we do get, you know, drawn into the stories about their private lives, ultimately that's not what we want them for. If you're, you know, a strong partisan, you want them to protect the seat or the White House or whatever the office, the comptroller for your party. You want them to push policies that matter to you. And in the end, we just don't expect them to live by higher personal values. Part of it is, you know, we live in an era also now where you are saturated with stories about political scandals, sexual and others. You're saturated with just the private lives of people. You know, this is reality TV, period. And so we see this stuff all the time. And so I think people just shrug when they hear a lot of these stories. So we don't care. We see it a lot. And all this adds up to an environment where you can get through these things other than, and this Spitzer's testing this, when you have done something that violates the law. And that's kind of a different category. So it's interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah. How do you see that, John, the fact that Spitzer did break the law?
I think it'll be a potential problem for him in a general election. And according to the polling we're seeing now within the primary, Spitzer is up 9 against Stringer already. So it may become a bigger issue, although New York City, you know, is a pretty liberal town, obviously. But the illegality of the act certainly weighs more than one that's just kind of creepy and generally immoral, but not really illegal.
There was a popular TV show, I never watched it, but I know a lot of people that did, called Scandal. I mean, just to underscore what Julian Zelizer was saying, John.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think people are willing to stomach people's personal failings, shortcomings. They see a lot of it in their own lives. But when you're in public office, they expect you to at least uphold legal standards. I mean, particularly in the case of Spitzer, I mean, he used to prosecute prostitution cases, and here he is spending upwards of $80,000 on high-end prostitutes. It could really be a problem for him. But again, the evidence we have as of today is that people are willing to give him a second chance. Now, whether that translates down the road, I don't know. But within the partisan environment of New York City, it appears not to matter.
And I wonder, Julian, people know their own private lives and whether people live messy lives. They just don't necessarily live them in public. How much you think that factors into the public's willingness to forgive because they know their own foibles?
I think that's important. And again, just to come back to our reality TV culture, we have our personal lives, we see the personal lives of others, and I do think that plays out in how people see politicians. Ultimately, politicians are human. They are human like the voters who elect them, and I think voters understand that. And I think, you know, we've been at a point for a long time where that's just not the biggest concern, and we just don't expect to see people living some kind of life that's different from the voter. I think the issue comes up when it seems to have some say about how they are as leaders. So as Spitzer, when he was governor, people would ask, why would he possibly do this? Why would he endanger himself, his party, his administration, just for this personal satisfaction? And some thought the same with President Clinton. He knew everyone was out to get him, so why did he do something to let his opponents get him? And I think that's the kind of question that sometimes bothers voters. How does it measure? How does it affect your leadership? But overall, People live messy lives, and they understand politicians do as well.
And picking up on those two examples, Julian, I mean, is it ego? Is it entitlement? Is it the aphrodisiac of power? Is that why politicians make such egregious mistakes in public?
I think there's different reasons, so we don't want to use one for all. But certainly, there's a long history of politicians who have big egos, who have a lot of people who are enamored with them. And often, they feel that they could do whatever they want and they should do whatever they want. And that ego can be very powerful. Part of it is probably a self-destructive tendency for some of these people. And again, this gets into the psychology of each leader, so I don't want to kind of give a blanket explanation for all of them. But even the most powerful and successful people probably have a little bit of this as well. And then some test the limits of what they can do. They're both powerful in the ego, both self-destructive, and seeing how far they can push everything.
And John, I don't know how far on a psychological limb you want to go, but do you think the sort of risk taking can be part of a profile of a political person?
It's possible. I mean, a lot of the literature seems to suggest that's the case. I don't think that's the case with everybody. But what is interesting about scandals and the reaction to them is whether or not the scandal itself reinforces a particularly negative trait that people were worried about beforehand. And in the case of former George Allen, who was running for Senate in Virginia, right, the famous Macaca scandal, which was, again, there was belief prior to that that Allen was an intolerant guy who may have, he had a Confederate pin on his suit at graduation of high school. People had some doubts about the guy. And then he's caught in this moment where he talks to a young Indian American using a very racially, ethnically derogatory term. And it just reinforced a lot of very negative traits about Allen. Now, Allen almost won the next race, but he was not able to come back, and he didn't win against Kane. The same thing could be said for Mitt Romney in many ways. So there was this latent idea about Romney being aloof, wealthy man who doesn't care about people, and then he's caught on camera in a clandestine room filled with donors disparaging half the country nearly, and it really reinforced a lot of negative traits. Whereas someone like Bill Clinton's scandal, it wasn't unknown about Bill Clinton's past. I mean, there had been all the quote-unquote bimbo eruptions. When this came up, people were shaking their heads and wondering what was he doing. But it wasn't necessarily out of character for Bill Clinton, and it probably didn't reinforce a negative trait in many people's minds.
Well, let's take a very short break. I do want to pick up on that. Talking with John Halpin, he's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he also co-directs and is creator of the Progressive Studies Program. Also with us, Julian Zelizer. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's written a whole bunch of books, including most recently Governing America, The Revival of Political History. And we are talking about second acts for politicians, especially after scandal or sex scandals. And we want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What's forgivable? What's unforgivable? Give us a call. We'll be right back.
The Delaware Art Museum in Wilmington supports WHYY and presents French Twist, masterworks of photography from Atjeh to Man Ray, on view through September 15th. Featuring vintage black and white prints from the golden age of French photography, this exhibition includes pioneering photojournalism, lyrical views of Paris streets and gardens, notorious creatures of the night, and surrealist experiments. For more information, 302-571-9590 or delart.org.
On October 1st, online marketplaces called Exchanges will go live, offering individual health insurance policies to those who don't have coverage. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Wendell Potter, a former health insurance executive now with the Center for Public Integrity, about what to expect as the Affordable Care Act takes effect. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, the U.S. spent $34 million on a base in Afghanistan that won't be used. Also, we'll look at a lot of the hot new music coming from down under. That's That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Julian Zelizer and John Halpin about politicians wanting and in many cases getting second chances after they have disappointed their constituents by misbehaving in office. And we're talking about whether an apology is enough to restore the voters' trust. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Julian, do you agree with what John was saying about politicians who are sort of expressing, as John wrote recently in Think Progress, you know, racist or misogynist thoughts? So that's kind of unforgivable when it comes to the public?
Well, I think the point that often, you know, the scandals, whether they're important or how they play out, relates to what we already think of a politician is absolutely true. So with George Allen, that comment played in to a perception that many people already had of him, and it became that much more damaging. Same was true with Romney. You could say when Newt Gingrich's relationship emerged right in the middle of the impeachment scandal, it played into a perception of hypocrisy, that Republicans were going after a president for things that a lot of people on Capitol Hill were also involved in as well. So that is true. But still, I mean, it's an amazing just to look at all the things that voters are willing to forgive politicians for, things that, you know, seem they would kill a career often don't. So I do think that matters, but they're still survivable.
But do you think, you know, if you just like someone and then they make a mistake or they do some of the things we've been talking about, that if you like them, you're willing to forgive them. If you don't like them, then it's unforgivable. Does it work that way, Julian?
Well, there's something to that. One of the scandals in the 1960s was New York Congressman Adam Clayton Powell, who was a very powerful African-American representative, chairman of Education and Labor, and he was a strong advocate of civil rights. He had all kinds of personal scandals. He was using public money to take trips with girlfriends to the Bimini Islands, and a lot of Southern conservatives were constantly going after him, trying to punish him, which ultimately happens. His supporters, you know, thought that, sure, he was involved in all kinds of inappropriate things, but ultimately the reason people were going after him was because he was a civil rights advocate, and they liked him, they stood by him, they protested when the House of Representatives punished him, and his opponents didn't see it that way. You know, they focused on the wrongdoing, the personal behavior. So the way they saw the scandal had a lot to do with how they saw him, his policies, and what he stood for.
John, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think Julian's correct on this. I mean, one of the interesting things about Anthony Weiner is that he was a pretty well-liked politician among his constituents prior to the sexting issue. And, you know, a majority of his constituents actually didn't want him to resign. So it's not surprising that he has 25% of the current vote in the crowded mayoral primary, because a lot of people liked Weiner beforehand. What's more interesting is that Spitzer is doing so well, giving the public's reaction to him prior to his downfall, which was actually quite negative. A lot of people did not like his tenure. They didn't like his demeanor. They didn't like they agreed with him being a fighter, but they didn't like him otherwise, thought he couldn't get along with people. A lot of the Democratic establishment was sort of done with him. That's why they're fighting against him now. So it is surprising, actually, given the reaction to Spitzer prior to his downfall, that he appears to be doing so well right now.
Julian, let me ask you about Mark Sanford, who, as we know, resigned as governor of South Carolina. He was, frankly, AWOL. No one knew where he was. He said he was hiking the Appalachian Trail. Now, I guess a euphemism for having an affair. He was in Argentina with his girlfriend and had used public funds in order to have this relationship with her. Just got elected to the U.S. Congress. Is there anything unique or special about this, Julian?
No, I think, although, in that case as well, there is this issue of misuse of public funds, which can be very damaging. Just to give you another older case, Congressman Wayne Hayes of Ohio was famous, involved in a scandal in 1976 where he was sleeping with his secretary and paying her, and she didn't even know how to type, she admitted to the press.
I remember that.
So Sanford had some of that. But in the end, you know, partisan imperatives are very strong today. Here's a seat. Sanford can win it. And I think a lot of Republicans are saying, you know, this is just not the issue that moves us. And many Republicans are also saying, we know people who've done things like this, variations of the relationship. And in the end, we want someone who can win rather than someone who is, you know, morally pure. And that's a very strong imperative, especially in this day and age where every seat in Congress matters. So I think they sized up the race. They sized up what Sanford was capable of. And there you go.
Well, and John, you had a piece in Think Progress recently, and you list things that you believe the public believes are unforgivable, the first one being politicians who are excessively hypocritical. You talk about Larry Craig. You talk about Newt Gingrich. Can you flesh that out for us?
Yeah, I mean, to reiterate some points that have been mentioned already, people expect politicians in many ways to be somewhat hypocritical. It's kind of the nature of the game. But when somebody violates a core principle that they publicly run on or talk about on a constant basis, whether it's family values or in the case of Craig, he was a famous sort of homophobe gay basher, and then he's caught with the wide stance in the Minneapolis men's bathroom, it really offended a lot of people across the board, but particularly in his home state. It's that level of hypocrisy that really bothers people. In the case of Gingrich, you know, he's going after Clinton for infidelities, and he's having a few of his own. He's a converted Catholic now, a big promoter of family values. He's been divorced multiple times. Now, in general, people don't care about that, but right. If you're going to run your public image based on a set of values or principles, and then you violate them in a very severe way, it can certainly hurt you.
Well, Julian, let me go back to when Newt Gingrich was running for president, and one of those Republican debates, John King, CNN's John King, asked him, I believe it was the first question about, he brought up examples of him, I guess, cheating on his wife, and Gingrich really went after John King. The audience loved it, you know, cheering him on, and Newt Gingrich won the South Carolina Republican primary. What do you make of that? And that seems almost like ancient history, but I think germane to what we're talking about.
Well, I think the context matters a lot there. So, you know, I do think the hypocrisy was a factor in the late 90s, in the middle of the impeachment, in the middle of a debate about the president's private relationship with an intern, whereas the context changed dramatically by the time Gingrich was running for president. And what he did was, in some ways, what Clinton did. Right. He refocused, he changed what people were thinking about by talking about the media, by talking about the person asking the question rather than the question itself. And again, like with Sanford, Republicans were hungry for a politician who could win, who would stand up for conservative values. And here they're showing conservative values are not always about sexuality. But, you know, they saw in him a winner for that primary, certainly, and they were willing to move on. The context had changed, and that affair was just not an issue for them anymore.
What did you make of that interchange, John?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, I think it's possible to move beyond past hypocrisy and get people to focus on a different set of values that are consistent with your overall belief systems. And, you know, you can see that with Wiener now. He has this new ambitious sort of single-payer healthcare plan for New York City. A lot of Democrats are going to like that, regardless of what he did in his personal life and that he was forced to resign. So there are ways to reinforce your more positive traits among your own voters and among people who may be skeptical with you. And you know, the Gingriches of the world are very good at refocusing public attention that way, particularly among their own partisans.
And that's John Halpin. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he's co-director and creator of the Progressive Studies Program, joining us from their studios. And joining us by telephone, Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author most recently of Governing America, The Revival of Political History. And we are talking about second chances in politics and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What is forgivable? What is unforgivable? Give us a call. Looks like we have Jack from Pipersville joining us on Radio Times. And Jack, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, I'm listening intently to the discussion. I'm hearing so much moral values and moral.
You know what, Jack? I'm going to have you call back because you have a terrible phone line, and we want to make sure that we can hear what you say. And again, you can call us back, Jack, at 1-888-477-9499. John, do you think, though, that Bill Clinton is sort of in a category by himself? Here's a guy who was impeached for lying about having an affair with an intern, and he is, at least within the Democratic Party, you know, a true elder statesman. What do you make of his, I guess, role as we talk about second, third, maybe fourth chances?
I mean, President Clinton certainly stands apart from most people involved in scandals, and a lot of it has to do with his personal relationship and ideological relationship to the Democratic Party. I mean, Bill Clinton was a contentious figure for a lot of his presidency, but a lot of people also within the Democratic Party particularly liked President Clinton, particularly his stance on helping the middle class, his jobs record, his willingness to fight against a rising conservative movement. There was a lot going for the president outside of this. And again, his marital infidelities were not something new. People were somewhat aware of them, and he had won re-election with that, you know, people knowing that. And, you know, but at the same time, you know, Al Gore might think differently about this. So it's an interesting question about whether Clinton scandals didn't really hurt Clinton, but actually hurt Al Gore. Gore famously, of course, didn't run on the Clinton record, which is phenomenal compared to what came with Bush. And, you know, a lot of that was probably due to the Bush theme of restoring honor and integrity of the White House. So Gore had to bear the brunt of a lot of Clinton scandals in some ways, or the worst part of it. And Clinton didn't have to run again. He was able to, you know, move over to a foundation, become sort of a world statesman, and really remind people of the good that he could do.
Yeah, what do you think, Julian? That's an interesting analysis there.
Yeah, and you could argue that, you know, Hillary Clinton might have suffered a bit as well, just from the, you know, lingering memory of what happened during the Clinton years, during her primary battles against Obama, that was, you know, part of what people were remembering. So, you know, sometimes the politician kind of gets away and survives and moves on and rebuilds himself, but the party doesn't. There are lingering effects, not just with Gingrich, but Livingston. You know, all the congressional Republicans involved in the impeachment in the late 1990s who ended up having similar kinds of relationships that they were attacking the president for, you know, in some ways it undermined a little bit of what the party stood for, the perception that the Republicans were genuinely interested in social matters. So the feedback effect is often bigger for succeeding candidates or the party itself than it is for the politician.
And what about Teddy Kennedy? How do you see him, Julian?
Well, he survived what was a very big scandal in 1969 when he was in a car that goes off the bridge in Chappaquiddick, and the fellow passenger, Mary Jo Kopechne, dies. And many people speculated that would be the end of it for Ted Kennedy, and he went on the offensive. It's an interesting kind of model for what politicians have done since. He appears on national TV. He apologizes for irresponsible behavior and says he should have admitted the incident right away. It takes him time to tell people what happened, and the scandal certainly destroys his presidential aspirations. And after that, there's really no chance of him becoming president, when he really was a shining voice for the Democratic Party. But he survives. He rebuilds himself. He becomes a senior Democratic senator. When he passes away, the emphasis really wasn't on the scandal, but was all the legislation he'd been able to accomplish and the negotiations he had fostered on Capitol Hill. So he sets out a model for how to survive a scandal, and he also shows very much how you can truly rebuild your career, even if this is lingering, even if this pushes off other possibilities, you still can rebuild your political career.
Let me get some callers in. We have, looks like Rhett from Lewistown, Pennsylvania. And Rhett, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I am wondering if your guests can give any examples of personal figures that have fallen from grace, recovered, and been accepted by the public again, and been even more powerful almost as a result of that defiance of the the defiance of, you know, what would in many cases just completely knock somebody out of the arena. But because they come back, do they feel even more empowered and kind of have their egos inflated even further? So I'll listen off the air.
Well, Red, I just have a quick question for you. Do you have someone in mind when you're asking that question?
Well, in a way, I do. I'm a supporter of Bill Clinton and was during those years, and was happy that he was able to kind of deflect the attacks and put it into the context of it being a personal area of his life that really did not have any place in his professional kind of capacities. And I was happy that he was able to do that, and felt in my own way even better about him as a result of his capacity to do that, to deal with that. So I'm just wondering if your guests have any thoughts on that and made any observations of their own.
What do you think, John?
The Clinton example is obviously a good one. I think Julian's description of Kennedy fits that description as well. I mean, Mark Sanford, he's not going to be a powerful guy, but that's quite a turnaround. I think the Wiener example, if he's to move from a congressional spot to mayor of the largest city in the country, that will be quite impressive in terms of redemption. There may be more of these going forward. It may be easier in a time of high partisanship for people to rally the troops in the face of scandal and become even more popular. So it may, Rick's point may be extremely important going forward in a time of ideological polarization, where the instinct now will be, well, don't let the other side take out our guy. Let's really fight Clinton style. Let's really fight Spitzer style, whatever it is. And it may actually rebound to their benefit.
And Julian, what Red is also talking about, and I think this always comes up in a discussion like this, which is, you know, how does a politician separate their public and private life, and how does the public, you know, view their private life when they learn about it?
Yeah, I mean, to answer that and his question, another person that comes to mind is Barney Frank, who had a scandal, I believe, in 1990. One of his assistants was running a male prostitution ring out of his home, and you know, Frank issues an apology. I said, you know, he didn't know about this, and not only does, you know, Frank survive, he becomes insistent his personal life has nothing to do with what he does in office. He becomes in some ways more defiant against these kinds of attacks, and he also becomes one of the more important voices in the House Democratic Caucus, really a key player, I would argue, in the last 20 years. So I think there is a case where the attack is not just survive, but it teaches him to separate that, and he's just very defiant that his private life, including his being a homosexual, should have nothing to do with what people say about his role and record in office.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about the public and private lives of elected officials and how and whether they survive or whether a political or sexual scandal. Talking with Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University, John Halpin, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Red, thanks for the call. 1-888-477-WHYY. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase offers lung screening for individuals at high risk of lung cancer, based on results of a national trial which showed death from lung cancer was reduced by 20% with early detection. Qualified candidates receive a low-dose CT scan and an appointment with an advanced practice clinician to discuss the results that same day. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
The Hamilton Public Media Commons Young Journalist Summer Camp is back at WHYY. Students in grades 9 through 12 will create video news stories and learn from award-winning journalists and media professionals, interviewing, shooting and editing video, and more. Two-week sessions starting August 5th. RSVP at whyy.org/camps. And young movie makers can submit entries for WHYY's Youth Media Awards now. Visit whyy.org/awards to learn more.
Carrying the responsibility of workers' rights in Bangladesh on the clothes on our backs here in the United States.
Anywhere in the world, the standard should be that that hard day of work shouldn't end up in the potential of losing your life.
Senator Robert Menendez, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, on how to improve conditions in the garment factories of Bangladesh and around the world. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Julian Zelizer and John Halpin about second chances in politics and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. John, let me go back to the piece you wrote in Think Progress. Another, as you write, unforgivable behavior are politicians who are predatory, narcissistic, or generally just creepy. And your two examples are Senator John Edwards and Dominique Strauss-Kahn. Again, expand on that, and then we'll get back to our callers.
Yes, well, you know, there are some personal behaviors that are that cross the line. Obviously, Wiener's behavior is quite creepy, but, you know, was it really that dark compared to John Edwards, who is running for president? Fathers a child, an illegitimate child, with a campaign videographer while his wife is dying. That's really dark, and it really bothered a lot of people on multiple levels. And the ongoing denials of it, the evasions, he denied the child. He, you know, up until the end, he's indicted on this. Eventually, you know, acquitted in a partial mistrial. I think it's going to be very difficult for John Edwards to ever make it back into public races. He's just now starting to restart his legal career. He's going to open a new firm this fall, but that's a pretty dark fall from grace. Dominique Strauss-Kahn, even though he just was in the French Parliament talking, it's unlikely that he will ever be able to recover from the multiple criminal investigations of possible predatory assaults, prostitution, other things of that nature. That, you know, again, there's something quite predatory in that, that that's different than a run-of-the-mill sex scandal. So I think those things do reach a different level. And so then the question becomes, in the case of Wiener and Spitzer, do those sex scandals reach that level? And I think the evidence right now among Democrats is no, not at all.
Well, and Julian, and then I do want to get to our callers or get back to our callers. I mean, what is the attraction, I guess, for a disgraced elected official? Is it just that politics is kind of where the action is and it's just something that they're almost like bred to want?
Absolutely. I mean, these are people, you know, at the most cynical level who want power, and for them, power is even more attractive than money, often. And they have worked their whole lives, usually, to get these kinds of positions, and they, you know, feel devastated if something like a sex scandal moves them off that course. So part of it is simply that drive. That's who they are. Mm-hmm. At a less cynical level, these are often people who do care about public policy. We forget that part of politicians.
Right.
And they do want to make a difference, and they want that second chance. Sometimes the two feelings are combined. They want to get back in to do good. They want to make up for what went wrong, and they want to affect the policy arena. Certainly you can argue that with Spitzer for his arrogance and for all the reasons many people didn't like him. He was also someone genuinely going after Wall Street and abuses in how the regulatory system worked, and really did believe in trying to fix that. Same with Wiener. He was kind of on the left of the Democratic Party, believed the party wasn't taking a strong stand on key issues like the public option in health care. And my guess is he wants to get back into the game, not just for the power, but for the policy. And so this doesn't end their drive. Very often they want to get back if they can. I think both of these guys are watching. They see Sanford, Spitzer sees Sanford and Wiener, and they say, this is my opportunity, and they want to still achieve the goals that they originally set out to do.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We have Colleen from Princeton joining us on Radio Times. Colleen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
My question for your guest is whether or not they believe if a spouse stands by
the politician that has had a marital infidelity, whether or not that makes a difference in their recovery or able to restart their career.
What do you think?
I'll take my comment off the air.
Okay, Colleen, thanks for the call. John, do you think that matters?
I think it can matter, although we have some counterexamples, obviously, in the Sanford marriage that broke up, and it didn't affect Mark Sanford one bit in many ways. It took a little while, but that marriage fell apart. In the case of Clinton, obviously, that potentially helped. In the case of Wiener and Spitzer, you had strong spouses who supported their fallen husbands. And it probably did help. I mean, there's no question that Wiener's wife, she's a brilliant strategist who's helping him figure out a way to get back into the public's eye and do the work that Julian was talking about. So a supportive spouse certainly can help, but it does. In the case of Sanford, obviously, mm-hmm. it doesn't necessarily have to be there.
How do you see it, Julian?
Yeah, it helps, and it's part of getting over that idea that we were talking about, that the creepiness factor, that in the end the politician wants to be able to get back to voters and they'd still be willing to shake his hand. And I think if a spouse is saying this was a mistake, I'm still here, I'm not going away, at least it gives the perception, whether it's true or not, that there's some solidity in the person we're going to have to evaluate for office. But it's not a guarantee of anything. Another case is Wilbur Mills, who in 1974, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, most powerful Democrat in Congress, is caught with a stripper near the tidal basin. A car is stopped. The stripper, the Argentine firecracker, Fanny Fox, runs out and jumps into the tidal basin. Wilbur Mills runs out after her. This is all caught on camera. It's a huge embarrassment. Mills' wife stands by him. He is reelected a month later. This is October 1974. But then, 1 month after that, he appears at Fanny Fox's first striptease show. He stumbles on stage in Boston, and that's it. He has to resign after that, and the protection and insulation that his wife had actually given him doesn't work. So there are limits to what that can do, but it's certainly helpful in the, again, toolkit that a politician needs to get over this.
And, John, we're speaking 100% about men, and maybe there are not enough women in Congress, and in 100 years we can be talking about that. But do you think there's a significance to that?
I think the gender difference, yeah. One thing we haven't discussed is the relationship of the offender, the male offender in this case, to the spouse or significant other. And if you take the case of John Edwards again, I mean, here, he talked a lot about his family life and how much he loved his wife, very devious behind her back, and, really mistreated her in a vulnerable moment. People are not going to forgive that. There's some questions about Governor McDonnell in Virginia and the gifts campaign finance scandal that's emerging down there, about whether he's been sufficiently supportive of his wife, who's been hit on some of this. And so it kind of goes both ways. In the case of Wiener and Spitzer, they both have sort of gushingly talked about how wonderful their wives are, and that probably helps to rehabilitate the overall image. But in terms of gender scandal the other way, you don't see as many of these, really. And, the question, there were some questions about whether Michelle Bachmann was leaving Congress early because of some looming campaign finance scandals. But in general, this is almost always a thing that affects men, or men are the perpetrators.
Let me see what Mark from Tioga has to say. Mark, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Listening to this conversation, do you sort of get the impression that rehabilitation from political sex scandals is a relatively recent phenomenon, as if the country had become more liberal in the last 30, 40, 50 years? But if memory serves me correctly, one of the more notable sex scandals to have ever occurred in American politics was in the 19th century, when Grover Cleveland fathered a child out of wedlock, and this became widely known, and people may have thought that his political career was toast, but one of the political cartoons that I can remember is one of a baby in its mother's arms screaming, "Ma, Ma, where's my pa?" And the response was, "He's off to the White House, ha, ha, ha." Mm. So rehabilitation, from political sexual scandals apparently is not as new a phenomenon as it might seem to people looking now.
Well, and Mark, I appreciate the call, and that's why we have a historian on the show to talk specifically about some of these incidents in the past. And, Julian, the ball is in your court. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree at all. We talked about this earlier. The 19th century was filled with sex scandals. Grover Cleveland is one of the more famous examples. Andrew Jackson is another person who's involved in a rather famous sex scandal and is able to survive. Thomas Jefferson is also involved in a scandal. These scandals just fill the history books, and I do think they play out differently in different historical periods, and it's important to note how our current media might change the context for how you survive these scandals and the impact they have on the electorate. But there really hasn't been a huge period where these scandals don't emerge and politicians live through them. So this core idea that in the end we're so much different than France or we're so much different from Italy in the way that we treat this really doesn't always match the historical record. And it's not just about America since the 60s. It's about America since the founding. We are often willing to forgive the personal indiscretions of our politicians, even if we argue that we have this higher standard. So Cleveland is a wonderful example, reelected, and the scandal in the end doesn't bring him down.
Mark, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And again, you can call 1-888-477-9499. I mean, John, the media loves this stuff. I mean, I can only imagine the tabloids in New York City with the Spitzer-Wiener races underway.
Yeah, it certainly is going to make for an interesting fall in terms of the race. But, you know, again, as Julian continues to say, and correctly, it's likely, given historical evidence and what we know from political science research, that these scandals won't matter as much as other things. Now, it's not to say that all scandals don't matter. One thing we haven't talked about are other types of scandals. Sex scandals, personal indiscretions that are not really over the line, appear to be forgiven fairly easily. Other types of scandals do not. Outright corruption, like William Jefferson with the $90,000 in the freezer, Duke Cunningham, Kwame Kilpatrick, the former mayor of my city where I live in Baltimore, Sheila Dixon, who stole gift cards that were designed for the poor. I mean, these types of scandals really can hurt people, and I think the political science research supports this notion that corruption scandals really are the worst. I doubt we'll see Tom DeLay making a big comeback anytime soon, given his past. So it may just be the nature of sex scandals versus other types of scandals that we see more forgiveness.
Well, if you're talking about corruption, it's public corruption, is it not, John?
Yeah, I mean, when you violate the laws you're sworn to uphold, it reaches a different level in some ways. And when you do something egregious in terms of undermining public confidence and trust in government, and that you can carry out your duties honestly and legally, it's a different standard.
Let me see what Harry from looks like Elkins Park has to say. Harry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I just want to make two comments from a different angle, both on Clinton and Adam Clayton Powell. On Clinton, I mean, the polls always showed that the public was never terribly interested in what that was. They not only forgave him in advance, but they didn't even blame him to a certain degree. There was also an overstep by the special prosecutor. Sam Dash resigned, you know, when they went to publish that. And as a footnote, if the senator from Pennsylvania had stepped up as the lawyer for the law person for the Senate and said this is bogus, it would have ended right there, which he didn't do. But on Adam Clayton Powell, the other issue was the fact that the House of Representatives, being a club, reached out to Adam Clayton Powell and said, look, you need to be censured. We need an admission of guilt from you. We will then censure you. Clayton Powell decided to ignore that. He stayed in Aruba on vacation, and consequently he took a far deeper fall than he had to, because he didn't like the way it was going to look for history for him.
Well, Harry,
and I'll take yes.
No, that's fair enough. I was going to say, let's hear from Julian Zelizer. Does he have that right, Julian?
Well, Powell was certainly defiant, and he refused to kind of admit he had done something. He argued that was so much different than what all the other senior people were doing. The real drive, though, toward the harshest punishment ended up coming from a lot of the Southern conservatives who really didn't care or were involved in personal indiscretions as bad as him. What they really cared about were his civil rights position. So it's true he was defiant, but I'm not clear in the end that, you know, if he had had some admission or agreed to some kind of censure, it would have worked out that way. The drive to get him was quite strong. And on the corruption issue, I think that's true. I think, you know, there's all these cases like the whole Jack Abramoff scandals before 2006 where people are caught red-handed doing something bad, that can really bring you down. Voters don't seem to like that. On the other hand, both with sex scandals and those kinds of corruption scandals, it's interesting how these personal stories, individual stories, you know, often do take us away from bigger problems with the system. So some people would argue the real scandal is, you know, money in politics and the way our campaign contributions work. That, in the end, doesn't generate the same kind of attention, systematic attention, as, you know, do these individual cases. Sure. So we want to know all about Spitzer and Wiener, but, you know, we don't really get all, you know, angry and driven by stories about how our basic lobbying works and campaign finance works. So those kinds of distinctions are interesting to think about why Americans focus on some questions and not others.
Well, we have to leave our conversation with that question hanging out there. Julian Zelizer, thank you, as always, for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And John Halpin, thank you for joining us as well.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. John Halpin, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, co-director and creator of the Progressive Studies Program at the Center. And Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author most recently of Governing America, The Revival of Political History. We appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. And you can find out much more about this program, including a podcast, Twitter, email, the archives. I'm Artie Moscowane. Stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.